Bonsoir tout le monde. Malheureusement, mon français n'est pas suffisant pour donner cette conférence en votre langue et je dois parler en anglais. My English is also not very good, so I'll try to do my best. First of all, I would like to thank Professor Jean-Jacques Blanc to invite me for giving this lecture. And we are going to talk a little bit about the Neanderthal cannibalism, and especially we are going to discuss and explore what are the data, what are the implications, and what kind of conclusion we can gather from the study of a new sample of Neanderthals that we are working on, and is located in northern Spain. The title of the lecture is Neanderthal Cannibalism, the case of El Cidrón, Spain. And this is because we have already published the conclusion that in the bone assemblage that we have found in the El Cidrón site, we have already identified traits enough to state that there was some kind of cannibal behavior at this site. And this is because we had found very clear marks. You can see this example. We will develop this later, what is called the cut marks that has been produced by the stone tools when the corpses, the bodies are defleshed, and they produce this kind with the contact of the knife, the stone knife with the bones, produce this kind of marks and many others we will see later that we call cut marks. So this is very clear in this specimen and many others. And when we publish this for the first time, we got the conclusion that the reason of this kind of cannibalism was because of the need of food. That was related at that time with some lines that appears in the teeth. Professor Rublin told before about these hypoplasia lines. And in the sample, there are all the individuals present this kind of hypoplasia lines. And we got a preliminary conclusion relating this cannibalism because the people were hungry, let's say in that simple way. Afterward, we had found more stuff, more fossils, more specimens, and we realized that the pattern is much more complex than this. And we are still working on that. And in that lecture, I'll try to develop a little bit what are we learning. As we know, cannibalism is the act or the practice of humans eating the flesh or the internal organs of other human beings. This practice is, of course, happening in many other species. And in the last years, we are realizing that the cannibalism or anthropophagy is becoming a common practice in several prehistoric sites. Especially, we found in the Atapuerca TD6 level in the Grandolina site, what we call Homo antecessor at the time, and there are also clear signs of cannibalism 800,000 years ago. Also, among Neanderthals, we know several cases that has been previously recognized: Moulager Seat, Zafarraya, Loctus, Combre Granal, and Cidrón, and several others. So it's a practice that actually, also in L'Arago, that's Middle Pleistocene site that is here in France, also there are clear evidence of cannibalism. And afterwards, many other sites in different prehistoric ages, Neolithic, Bronze Age, are also in the Middle Ages, and in many reports coming from the 18th century reports from other parts of the country. So the example of cannibalism has become something that is generally recognized. When I was preparing the lecture, actually, in order to organize a little bit the information, I asked myself why is relevant to scientifically study the cannibalism? Apart from this kind of perhaps morbid interest that could be general, but what could be the real scientific interest for the study of cannibalism? First of all, it is clear to recognize that this is a marker of the human behavior. We are interested in human evolution, and actually, and the information that is recorded in the archaeological and paleontological record is not big enough, and we look for any kind of evidence for exploring anatomy, biology, behavior, cultural evolution, whatever, in the archaeological and paleontological record. So if we study this kind of marks on the bones of animals, it's clear that we have to study the same pattern, or say the same marks in human bones. That's clear enough. But also, in a perhaps deeper way, we know that the cannibalism perhaps is one of the greatest taboos in the Western civilization. It is actually, together with the incest, probably the great taboo in our civilization. And we may ask, what are the roots of this taboo, and what are the manifestations when the some people, societies, culture do not follow this common taboo in our common culture? Actually, this taboo has produced a strong reaction against the recognition of these practices. And there is a classic book by Arendt that it says that there is no satisfactory first-hand account of this act, the cannibalism, as a socially approved custom in any part of the world. So, meaning that this author and many others say that there was not enough evidence, first-hand, good quality, to recognize that this practice was standardized, institutionalized in any culture. Afterwards, as I said before, there is an increasing evidence that cannibalism, formerly thought to be a rare and abnormal human behavior, was practiced widely by our ancestors. This is a conclusion that is nowadays in our field that we have to recognize, all of us, without any kind of prejudice, that this practice was done by many people in our ancestry. The point now is to understand why and how and what could be the implication for that. And also something very important that the people who have studied this kind of practice in recent times and historical times is the recognition that cannibalism is always in any kind of manifestation, in any variety of behavior of that practice, is always surrounded by symbols, ritual, and emotions, such as compassion, respect, love, violence, contempt, hate, etc. So it is not a neutral practice, let's say. It's always charged with a strong emotion. Whatever. That's the point to understand which ones, but always are surrounded by this kind of strong emotions. And as I said, we're going into this site, what is called El Cidrón, in order to learn a little bit more of this. The El Cidrón site, we go first to just to present the site and the sample, and then go into the details of the analysis. And because in this particular case, as we will see later, the study of the archaeological, the fossil assemblage itself, and the geology, the sedimentology, it's important in order to have a complete picture of this behavior in this particular case. We will see later. First of all, Cidrón is located in north of Spain, in Asturias, here. And this is as many other Neanderthal sites, it's a karst system, so it's located into a cave. And the cave is the system, the karst system is developed along a long gallery with several small, more or less perpendicular galleries. The site is here, what we call the Osario Gallery, and this is the plant with the square for the excavation that is projected on the floor. And we have some picture here. For instance, this is the Gallery River, so this one, where we install, let's say, underground lab for the preparation of the fossils. And we can see here, well, this is in that picture, we are inside this small, so you can appreciate here how is the very, very restricted, very, very small gallery, narrow. And just an example of the bones, for instance, is the two metapodials in anatomical connection that is here. And from here, from that site, come a new collection of fossil Neanderthals. By the way, I have to say that last year we finished the excavation of this site. In a way, as an exception, we finished because we have excavated all the sediment that was there. Usually, in most of the cases, when in caves and sites that are much larger, when archaeologists and paleontologists excavate, usually they leave some kind of record for the next students and to leave for other people to study and to check the opinions and so on, some kind of. But in this particular case, because the site is so small and the volume of sediments with fossils was relatively small, and because all this sediment was full of Neanderthal fossils, we decided to finish everything. So actually, we can say now that the Sidrón sample is already complete. We are not going to find any more fossils. So the conclusion we can get, and actually some of the aspects that we can now present this is because we can be sure that there is no more fossils. So the information we have is the information we have. No more is coming. Okay, what is important is the fossils. You can see some examples here, some mandibles and maxillary. You see a block of sediments with some, actually has been excavated in the lab, this block. You can see a foot in anatomical connection, which is important for the interpretation of the pattern. So maxillary, I said. And there are also a few stone tools, relatively few, more or less 300 stone tools, which is also important. And the number of specimens is more or less 2,500, what for a Neanderthal site is a large number. I have to say that actually because of the cannibalism, many of the specimens are tiny ones, so they are not, these two, more than 2,000 specimens are not these kind of really nice fossils. Many of them are small fragments. Actually, most of them because of the human behavior that has produced this breakage. And we have identified a minimum number of 13 individuals, which is a large number for a site like this. And also, it's important that every skeletal regions are represented at the site. Here we have a few examples. This is the most complete specimen, or the most complete individual. This is what we call juvenile one. And actually, is, as you can see, a nearly complete, apart from the tibia and the foot in this individual, nearly complete juvenile, which is also important for the interpretation, apart from the fossil itself, that is wonderful for human paleontologists, is the preservation of this is actually a date in itself. And we also have some fragments of a skull. This is actually, once we had finished the excavation, this is the best skull fragment in the sample, because most of the skull has been broken. And this is from the anatomical point of view, from the evolutionary point of view study, actually this is not good news, because everything is broken. But from the behavior point of view, it's a real advantage. So it depends what is your interest, you are happy or not with this. And this is a coxal and the mandible of this. There is an important point here that is most of the bones, not all, but many of them are covered by a calcareous crust. And this is important because the marks we are going to study, the cut marks and so on, many of them are below this thin calcareous crust, which means that these marks are original of the times of the burial at least. I said that because in some cases, some of these marks has been confused with the marks that has been left by the instruments when we were digging. And in the literature, there are some cases of discussion whether they were, they represent, this mark represent evidence of ancient tactics, or it was just the evidence of bad excavation, let's say in that way. Anyway, in that case, as you can see here, the bones are covered with this thin crust. Just as a little detail, we have studied, this is not the day to talk about this. Jean-Jacques was referring before to the genomic and genetic studies in Asian DNA. We have studied at Del Cidrón. We have participated in several studies with dealing with Asian DNA. And you can see here this little hole in this pieces of bone that has been, this is the drilling to take a sample for the study of Asian DNA. The dating of the sample is more or less 49,000 years. So it's, if we put here the fossil record in the Europe from the Middle Pleistocene to the classic Neanderthals, El Cidrón belong to this group of Neanderthals that we call usually classic Neanderthals. So it's between the 100,000 until the 40,000. Years, or more or less this group. And as I said before, there are other examples in the record, for instance, Larago, and other here, Natapuerca TD6, that also there are evidence of cannibalism. Here I will present you the individuals from El Cidrón in an artistic representation. And as I said, there are 13 individuals identified. There are 3 adult males, 4 adult females, 3 adolescents, 2 males and 1 female, 2 male juveniles, and 1 infant. Apart from the infant, that is the remains that we have found from that represent this individual, they are very, very few. All of them are represented in a way, especially in the dentition that has been our way to define this individual. We have used, as the forensic do usually, we have used the dentition to put together the different pieces and to assemblage and to define in the different, in the adults, individuals, the adolescents, and the juveniles, like that. And the, you can see here, several examples of this. The best, actually, the, one of the better parts that has preserved, the mandible and the maxillary. And the great question, our major question in that side is, what is the process, why 13 individuals of different ages, both sexes, are together in this little chamber, in this little cave? This is one of the question of this site, and this is what we are working on. And to trying to answer this big question for us, we are going to explore now different parts of the evidence, starting from the sedimentary or the geological settings of the site. As I said before, this is it's a karst. Again, this is the Rio Gallery, the River Gallery, the small chamber where is the well, were the site in here. This is the site, which is another picture of the inside of the view, which is pictorially is nice. We are now looking at the details now. So the fossils, all of them come from here. This is a section of the along the gallery. Again, this in situ fossils. And what we realize, and the geologists realize, that this even being a very small place, the spatial complexity was very high. So the sediments do not organize in fine and organized layer, that is something that is complex and in some ways is chaotic. But it's important. In the excavation, some details here you see, and this is what it's not easy to see, but what are here is all along the gallery is the drawings of the sedimentary section, the stratigraphic section, every half a meter. So it's in a way a sort of, let's say, geographic tomography, because we have excavated and drew every section in order to complete the whole volume of the sediments and to give an interpretation. And all the fossils come from Unit 3, it's here, and the organization of this is fit well what the geologists call the mud flow. So that means catastrophic entrance of sediments, water, stones, and bones with any order inside. This is what usually called mud flow. And just as a curiosity in the work we are doing and developing at the site is that what we call a clean excavation. We have developed a protocol for the extraction of bones, trying to avoid any contamination with our own DNA. Every day is less and less important, the contamination, because we know more about the ancient DNAs and genomes, but at the beginning it was really important to be sure that the sample we took from the site was not contaminated with our own DNA, because we didn't know what was the difference at the time. And we developed this clean excavation, what consists mostly to be addressed with this kind of lab coat, and to keep the samples in fridge, cold, and then it's frozen. When we reached the hotel, we had there refrigerator, and we kept the samples frozen. Of course, this protocol was developed at that site because it's an exception, because we were sure at the time that actually when we were on the excavation, we were almost sure that the next bone we could found was Neanderthal. Because as we will see, actually most of the assemblages are only Neanderthals. So we, in most of the sites, in most of the places, it's not possible to do that because you never know what I'm going to find a new piece of Neanderthal. Actually, the proportion between animal remains and human remains is quite imbalanced in favor of the animal's remains. But in here is exactly the contrary. What actually is another date, another information to interpret the assemblage. Okay, and going back to the model we developed, we can see here a section of the mountain, and here we see what we said that the river gallery, and this is the small Osario gallery, and on top of this there is another floor of the karst with also cavities, and because of the whole information and this chaotic state, we reached the conclusion that the El Cidrón assembly was in a what we call secondary position. So it was first deposit in a perhaps in an upper level. We don't know at the end, we didn't find the entrance because we were looking for this at the slope of the mountain, but probably there are many collapses there. But what we know is that the bones we are studying was first deposited in an upper level. Then there was a kind of collapse like that, perhaps with a big storm, and the water flowed the cavity, and suddenly everything collapsed into a lower level, into a lower gallery. And it is in there where we find the assemblage. So we are studying an assemblage that it is archaeologically in a secondary assemblage. In a secondary position, sorry. Okay, but this is the map of the gallery, and these rows indicate the different entrance. And to complicate a little bit more things, this is in green are the surface where human remains has been found. That's the interpretation of the different layers of the sediments. And here there has been a later flow of water that perhaps has moved in a third location, some of these fossils. We don't know this. The only thing we know is that there are some kind of water flux in there running. Okay. And let's go now to explore what is the information that is into the bones. exactly into the gums. And we call taphonomy the study of these kind of marks. And what, as I said before, in the Sidrón, there are very few animal remains. Most of them are teeth, and also we are finding horses, deers, boars, canidae, and birds. And also most of the animal remains are teeth, as I said, but also there are some kind of patella and antlers and metapodials. This is the example, is a rib of a small medium-sized mammal, and what we see here is the mark, the depression that has been produced by the molar of a carnivore when it was biting this bone. This is the only example we have in the assemblage. There is no evidence of this kind of marks, carnivore marks, on the human bones. No. Also, human remains recovered at El Cidrón do not present any modification either for carnivores, as I said, and weathering. Weathering is the action of the atmosphere, the water, the sand, the roots, and so on the bones when they are exposed and the atmosphere environment. There is no evidence of atmospheric alteration. What this implies, a burial process that was very rapid. Because usually we have the experience, we know that when the bones are exposed and deposited in a floor, very quickly other animals come, bite a little bit, or intensively, depends, and also the sun, the wind, the water produce any kind of alteration, roots, small roots, and this process usually happens very rapidly. In this case, there is no at all, there is no action of these agents, so we can say that the burial process, once the human remains, the Neanderthal remains, were deposited on the floor, suddenly it was covered very rapidly. This is another date, another information. Okay, when we are studying the different marks and the taphonomical imprints and the taphonomical information that we can record from the bones, we can ask how to detect human-induced treatment on the human bones. And in previous studies has been clarified that there is a list of different marks that can talk about the cannibalism. For instance, the cut marks, bone flakes, conchoidal scars, percussion marks, tooth marks, human tooth marks, and several others. There is an important point in this, that because the presence of cut marks, so I repeat, the marks that the knife, stone knife, left on the bone surface, just the presence of cut marks, it doesn't mean cannibalism. It doesn't imply immediately cannibalism, because we know that many societies deflesh the corpses, treat the bodies, and they behave in a ritual way, but they don't consume the flesh. They don't consume the organs. So just having cut marks, it doesn't immediately imply the act of cannibalism. You need another information plus the cut marks in order to conclude that has been anthropophagy. And for instance, we have here the percussion marks. It's a fragment of femur. And this sort of, and clear enough in this humerus located here, this is a cut mark, very clear. And also in this mandible, you can see this small lines here that has been produced cutting the muscles that are attached here, perhaps the masseter muscle cutting here, and has produced these kind of marks. Okay. In front of this information, and let's say the theoretical background in a bit of the cannibalism is to explore, and the end of this kind of study is to explore the causes of the cannibalism. Why? And what is the pattern? And in that case, there are many, in the literature, there are many classifications, many ways, and many names has been used to classify this kind of practice. But in a general way, if we attend to the origin of the consume, so the individual has been consumed, there are two big and important types, let's say, of cannibalism. One is the, what is called endocannibalism and what is called exocannibalism. That is, the endocannibalism says that the eating of someone from within the group is because of that of endo. And also, and the eating of someone from outside the group is exocannibalism. And if we look at the purpose, and we ask why, what is the reason, what is the purpose of this, it has been simplified in what we call mortuary cannibalism, that is usually linked to a ritual or something similar, the mortuary. There is another kind of cannibalism, that is warfare, that is between enemies, and usually is linked to the idea of a trophy. And then we have the most, perhaps the most familiar for all of us, that is called the survival cannibalism. That is this kind of situation, an extreme situation, when some people become isolated. We remember, for instance, in the Andes, the aircraft that took this accident, and these fellows stayed several weeks there in the mountains, and in order to survive, they consume human flesh, human tissues. And there is another kind of cannibalism that is called nutritional, that is just functional, in the sense that without, apart from our prejudice, social, cultural prejudice, there are some people that we know that they use the human bodies just as another kind of nutritional stuff. So our question is, what is the classification of the El Cidrón and other Neanderthals examples in order to understand what are the reasons and what are the patterns. Now we are going into the data. I want to just to show some tables without going into the details. That could be very boring. But we say that, for instance, when we study the anatomical representation, that is in the whole assemblage, we look at the number of remains, the number of elements, and the percentage of representation of this, the skull, the maxilla, the mandible, teeth, and so on, all the ribs, vertebra, coxa, femur, and so on and so on. And what we see is that the maxillary and upper limb bones, the upper limb bones, are the more represented elements. On the contrary, hyoid, carpals, and metatarsals are the less represented skeletal parts, and in general, bones of the upper limb are much better represented than bones from the lower limb. So the arms, this part of the skeleton, is much better represented in the assemblage than the lower limb. When we look at the anatomical representation by age classes, juveniles, adolescents, adults, and so on, we see that the anatomical representation by age is low generally, with adults showing the higher representation. Adults are the best represented. And cranial remains and upper limb bones, long bones, are the more represented elements. Cranial remains especially mandibles and maxillary. There is also a significant absence of some elements. And generally speaking, when the bones that has been preserved in the assemblage, in the sediment, are very good preserved, but there are some bones of low durability, such as the hyoid or scapula, that are missing. But there is also lack of remains of high durability, such as phalanges, carpals, and tarsals. So there are some bias in the assemblage. Something is missing. But it's also another point to put together with the other information. What are the possible causes of this? First, the corpses did not arrive complete to the deposit. We are talking about an original deposit, the primary and the secondary. And below, we found some parts that are missing. Why is the question? And an answer could be that the corpses did not arrive complete. So something happened in the first plate to remove part of these bodies. And this is, could be because there was a different transport, in a way, or because other Neanderthals retained some of the parts. We don't know that, but this, we just put the question. And also we know that the water activity that is, for instance, in that case, is, has been eroded by water, may have transported some elements. So I'm saying this just because, just to show you what is the difficulties to understand and to interpret the complete history of a fossil assemblage. There are many, many possibilities and many agents that are acting on the assemblage. Okay. Let's say, just to remember, let's remember a little bit what is the direct evidence. The marks we are studying, look at this. This is a very nice example because actually looking at this is like a regular pattern of cut marks in different directions. This is one of the most spectacular pieces. Also, these percussion marks. Here is a clavicle. This pattern and this is quite typical of the biting when people bite bones. This is the aspect that occurs. Our colleagues has worked, for instance, doing some kind of experimental approach, no, with the cannibalism, eating animals, trying to study and to detect what is the pattern of the what is the aspect of the bones after some kind of manipulations. And when we look how these evidences, these marks, are distributed in the sample, what we see is that all the skeletal elements present anthropogenetic modifications. This is important. All the skeleton has any kind of bones, sort of bone, has cut marks. It doesn't mean that all bones has cut marks, not at all, but all the skeleton, at least one, has a cut mark or are evidence of human-induced treatment. This is important. And on the whole, we can say that 6.7% of the recovered remains present sign of human-induced modification. That's the real value, more or less 6.7%. What's comparing with other assemblages and comparing with the assemblages of the animal remains that has been treated, this is a high figure. It's a really high figure. And the, well, this is this table is also the same, that how the marks are distributed in the bones, yet classifying by eight classes. And we can say that in some cases, the percentage of elements with anthropogenetic modification is very high. For instance, 100% of the recovered scapula show cut marks. 61% in humerus, in the clavicle 75, and so on. And something interesting is that the percentage of adult elements with anthropogenetic modification is relatively low, is the lowest in the sample, the adults. That's true that there are some other elements that we cannot say the age, because for now, a small fragment is really difficult in some cases say it, if it is coming from an adult or from an adolescent. So, but the data at the moment is that the lowest representation is in the adults. Now we can see some examples, for instance, in the phalanges. This is a picture of the cut mark. This groove you can see here, or also these are the mark properly, and this picture comes from the electron microscope. Mm-hmm. Also, we can see in this talus, which is peculiar here, this mark, really nice. By the way, the recognition of these cut marks has been worked for several years for many people. It's the people that study zooarchaeology, and they have typified, they have a study, and there is a typology that can be perfectly recognized under the microscope. So there is not just a mark like that. There is a typology that has been properly studied and properly defined. So and there was in the literature a long discussion how to distinguish what is a real cut mark from trampling, for instance, the mark that has been left by small grains of sediments when they scratch the surface of a bone. So when we call about this mark, some people could be skeptical to accept that this is a real mark from a stone tool, but believe me, these are real cut marks based on the previous studies of this kind of phenomenology. And also, there are other marks that is, for instance, what is called anvil strie, that is, in some cases, one of the criteria that are used to establish cannibalism is when the long bones has been broken. Marrow inside the long bones is really nutritious stuff. And animals look for this, and prehistoric humans look for this. And it's quite useful in animals' remains, find the long bones that has been broken. And actually, it's called the breakage pattern that is a subject of a study in itself. And when you find this in a human assemblage, means that there is an intention going into inside the bone, looking for something that is really nutritious. And in a way, it's leaving aside just the patterns that are related only with ritual or something like that. And when you broken a bone like that, there is a mark in here, but also there are some marks below where the bone is held, what is called the anvil strie. You see, and also another criteria is what is called green breakage. So it's fresh when the bone, there is a different pattern when the bone is fresh and is broken. This pattern of breakage is different than when the bone is dry. This is another really nice example. It's a clavicle. You see the cut marks. Mm-hmm. And also here, what is called peeling and biting. That is, this clavicle has been held like that and has been bitten by a Neanderthal. It's a clavicle of a Neanderthal has been bitten by another Neanderthal. And finally, has been broken like that. Mm-hmm. And this is something that has to be considered also in the pattern of cannibalism at Del Cidron, because this and the other example are some kind of exception that in the sense that has been manipulated much more than the other pieces, much more, especially this. Another example is on the fragment of a skull. You see this is a small fragment, as I said before. Anatomically, this is not really relevant because it's too small to study, to measure, to take landmarks or whatever, classic measurements. It's difficult to study anatomically this, but these pieces of bone come from the fracture of a skull that has been intentionally broken. And also, perhaps before broken, has been scratches like that. There is another kind of mark that is when you use the instrument, the tool, and it's moving on the surface, scratch. And the mark like this, you see, is different. It's not exactly a line, a neat line like the others. And this is when you see this at the electron microscope in here. With this information, we also make the question whether it was a bias between sexes. So the males are better represented, less represented than males or females, or the marks are more frequent in males or than in females. And especially looking at the humerus, we reached the conclusion that there is no bias by sex. So males and females were treated in a more or less similar way. Okay. Fine. Now we got a list of preliminary conclusions with this information, and the first conclusion we can reach is that all the individuals at the El Cidrón has been cannibalized, but not in the same way. This is really important. So all of them has been treated, but there is no standard way of treatment of these corpses. The analysis indicates that the processing was not intensive, and such a circumstance can be seen by no broken long bones and only 1 foot is disarticulated. What? So, all has been cannibalized. There is no standard way of doing, and the treatment has been not properly intensive. In many ways, has been superficial. So just some marks here, some marks there, some broken there, but not in a systematic way that is normal in the butchering of any camp. But as I said before, nevertheless, at the same time, we have documented isolated elements, this clavicle, metapodial phalanges, which present sign of a calm and careful processing, and consequently intensive butchering. So most, when we look at the complete assemblage, it's not unstandard, but in some particular cases, there has been a calm and intensive manipulation. The evidence comes from, you see here, a complete humerus, and this is broken, and this is broken. Mm-hmm. In some cases, has been broken, but not in all. For instance, there is only one example of a foot that has been disarticulated. It is actually very curious to see the details here in the tendons and so on. This is cut marks. And we have here in the block I showed you at the beginning of the presentation, this foot is in anatomical connection, so it has not been obviously disarticulated. And also, as I said before, this kind of exception, this something peculiar, that is cleaning of bones. And this has been in ethnographic and experimental studies related with some cases in which somebody take a bone, is chewing and so on, and then cut a little bit more in order to get more substance from the inside. So rework a little bit. Mm-hmm. So, second conclusion. There is not, as I said, a defined pattern of the processing of the individuals. And the absence of a clear processing pattern may indicate that, one, the remains correspond to different accumulations. So, because there is not an standard pattern, what could be the reason? But because in the original accumulation, there was different behaviors. One group makes something, another group makes another thing. So, there is not an standard. This is one possibility, and the other is that the fellows which participated in the butchering had very different skills. So there is no a butcher in the group. One is an expert and the others are not expert. That could be the other possibility. In order to test this possibility and checking the idea that all of this can, in, as I said, secondarily in one single event, but also the original deposition, the original event was also only one, we try to relate, this is the bones recovered from the different squares, and we have tried to fit, to refit in the bones. And what we found is that the refitting of bone have an elevated number of fragments coming from a single act of breakage. So we find in the assemblage, humerus, for instance, this, that is composed by different. So our conclusion is that originally the assemblage was produced in one single event. So the idea would be that the several individuals with different skills treat this assemblage, and then suddenly, by a storm, let's say, collapse and go into the second. So it's one event and another event for the transport. And the hypothesis that there is one single event is reinforced by other evidence. For instance, the stone tools refit. You have here an example, the flakes. Actually, this is a score. There are more than 60 flakes refitting. Mm-hmm. If there were several, they would be not possible to refit. And the percentage of refitting is really high. And also, in an indirect way, we have studied some genetic links among these fellows from the study of mitochondrial DNA, and we found that there are some kind of kinship relationship. So the group have some familiar relationship between that. So the idea is that there was a group of Neanderthals in some place upside or in a close to the entrance in a cave. There was an event of cannibalism, and their remains suddenly become collapsed after a transport and deposited in the place where we find. So, what could be the discussion? Well, first of all, the lack of animals, as I said before, The lack of animal remains in the assemblage would indicate that the original site of accumulation was not a campsite, so it was not a living floor of people or Neanderthal living there. Because in all the cases when there is a campsite, when there is a place where the people is living, there are many animal remains around. And here there is not. But a place where only humans were processes. So it's a very special and particular place. Whatever the reason, is very singular, very, very special in the archaeological and paleontological record. And then at the time of interpreting this, first we can discard this both, the survival and the nutritional cannibalism. I think within these two sort of cannibalism can be discarded because actually there is no evidence of survival and there is no evidence of nutritional. As I said, there is not an exploitation of this. It's just something that is in a way casual. So we have two choices. One, mortuary cannibalism, which could mean that the Neanderthals were doing, in a way, some kind of ritual, cannibal ritual. And in that case, it would be an endocannibalism, that is, members of the same group produce some kind of mortuary rit or whatever. Or the other choice is that is warfare cannibalism. So a group of Neanderthals perhaps attack another group of Neanderthals and left there behind this sort of assemblage. We are not sure about this because actually the ethnographic literature is very complicated dealing with this subject because the combination of the human societies produce very complicated patterns. In some cases, there are secondary burials. In some cases, the head is treated, in other, just the hand. So the pattern is not clear, and we are still working in the challenge to interpret it, whether it's a mortuary or this is a warfare cannibalism in the assemblage coming from El Cidrón. And with this, I finish my presentation, giving you thanks from El Cidrón. Thank you very much.